This is acting like my lava, this thing.
Boy. There you are, my lover. Just a minute. Balance is everything in life, kid.
I want to thank Mr. Williams for that very, very warm and lavish introduction. Although it's sometimes annoying to have such illusions of greatness bestowed upon you when you're laying off. I think that the dais and the speakers, and particularly your Toastmaster, will suffer by comparison to the very, very remarkable fine entertainment from the standpoint of playing and authorship that you've just witnessed by the players up on stage. I think that when the evening is over, you will say, weren't they good and weren't the speaker schmucks? In the last 10 years, I have probably made more public addresses and speeches than almost all of my contemporaries put together. And because of this, and because I speak in the next 90 days in 80 cities, I am called upon to prepare a manuscript at every place that I go. Because just a short time ago, I spoke in Detroit for the Knights of Columbus and addressed them as gentlemen of the B'nai B'rith. Therefore, I have several notes here. And I wear this glass with not any thought of being affected in any way, but I have trouble with this eye. And I'd rather have people say, isn't he eccentric, than the poor son of a bitch is going blind. I come to you tonight for my first visit to Damascus in many, many, many years. I come to you as the Abbot Emeritus of the Friars Club, and it is a great novelty for me to appear in front of an Aryan audience. There are very few actors at the Friars Club, and there are even fewer at the Lambs. There are actors there after a fashion, but a different kind of actors. There's none of the warm feeling, such as, hello there. I remember when we played in St. Louis. I was with the Prince of Pilsen. You were with the Merry Widow. Now you meet a guy, say, you remember me? I was on stage in APO. I was the squeak in the can on the X-Lax show. What are you doing now? Oh, I'm with Holtz Muff Syrup. They have a fine program. How is your Trendex fine? How is your ass? And that's how it goes on. I'm glad I'm finding these impromptu things because I brought with me a speech for a circumcision in Glendale. Speaker to address you is an associate and an artistic as well as a business partner of the guest of honor. Some people have called him a sort of a Second Avenue Gary Cooper. By the way, there's an interesting story about Mr. Cooper. It is told that there is an agent, I think Sammy Howard is his name, or some such name, synthetic name, but that is his name. And who had been going very, very badly. He had lost all of his clients, and added to this particular injury, monetary injury, he had, his wife had left him. He was broke and was en route to the psychiatrist and in a very low frame of mind in which he intended leaning toward the pistol, that kind of a thing. The bottle and the pistol. And suddenly a phone call came and said, "Sammy, this is Gary Cooper, and I want you to handle me." And this fellow said, "Now look, this might be some sort of a joke, but it isn't in my present state of mind," and he hung up. 10 minutes later, Gary Cooper walked in and said, "Sammy, I want you to handle me." And Sammy said, "Oh, my goodness, I can't." But he said, "Yes, I like you, and I want you to handle me. And there's nothing to worry about. I got a 7-year contract with Metro. You just go over and collect the money and just send it. You got nothing to worry about. Give me some paper, I'll sign it." Sammy got a contract out, says, "Here, Mr. Cooper, sign it right here." And Cooper said, "By the way, are you Jewish?" And Sammy said, "Not necessarily." I'm going to tell you an old story about vaudeville, almost a dramatization of how the vaudeville actors lived. For example, they had no association with the world outside. And particularly, there was a circuit called the Western Vaudeville Circuit out of Chicago. And these Western Vaudeville actors had no ambition to come to New York to play Hammerstein's or later the Palace. They lived on the Western Vaudeville Circuit. And particularly is the team that I mentioned. It was a Dutch comedian and a straight man called Fennevesian Gilbo. And Fennevesian Gilbo did the Dutch comedian act with the straight man, sang the parodies, and it wasn't much, but they eked out a happy existence, and as I say, in a world of their own. And Fennevesi, the Dutch comedian, had a most attractive wife. And when the bookings were low, and when they had no engagements to follow, Mrs. Fennevesi would go to Tink Humphreys, who ran the Western Vaudeville office, and she would generally come down with a week or two. Mrs. Fennevesi was evidently a woman of great charm and was able to persuade Mr. Humphreys to get this booking. So one day, Fennevesi and Gilbo were standing in front of Henrici's restaurant on Randolph Street, and they hadn't worked for some time, and Mrs. Fennevesi went up to see Humphreys and came down about an hour later and said, "Boys, not only have we got a week's work, but you open Dubuque on Sunday, 32 weeks straight. So-and-so got sick, disappointment, 32 weeks. Well, they were just filled with joy and had to tell it to all of their brother performers along. Now, of course, I must call your attention to the fact that in those days, a 32-week contract involvement meant nothing. It was all dependent upon your first performance. The manager could cancel you, and that was the end, and you went back and you paid your own fare, and it was all nothing. Anyhow, they didn't think of that, and they were walking along, and finally, a friend of us, he bumped into a fella called Peppino, the accordion player. He says, "Hiya, Peppy." He says, "What's new, friend?" He says, "New." He says, "Christ," he says, "Anna booked us 32 weeks. We open Sunday in Dubuque." And Peppino, the accordion player, says, "Geez, I'm sorry, it's Dubuque." He says, "Why?" He says, "Well, I'll tell you why." He says, "It's a very old theater, and the manager is rather superstitious. And there's been an owl in the balcony there for about 35 years. And there's a great comradeship between this manager and this owl, and he don't even listen to the reaction of the audience or watch the acts. He watches that owl. And if that owl gives it this, you're dead. You're canceled right away." So, friend of us, he says, "Oh, Christ, that's nothing." He says, "My Gilbo gets along with all animal acts, Jesus Christ. There'd be no trouble at all. He's with Crovney's monkeys and Ben's beetles. He made pals with everybody." So, walked again a couple of blocks, and he met a fellow named Ferry the Frog, a contortionist. "How are you, Ferry? How am I? This guy's Anna booked the opening Dubuque on Sunday." And Ferry the Frog says, "I'm sorry to hear about Dubuque." He says, "You mean about the manager and the owl?" He says, "No, he said, didn't that." He said, "The stage manager there is as handsome a fellow as you ever saw in your life. And lays everybody's gal or wife who comes into the place, and you'll have trouble. Your wife is an attractive woman." So he says, "Oh, she's not a chance." He says, "Anna goes upstairs with the Lux. I play Romy with the boy. You get nowhere with her." Anyhow, with these two hazards in front of them, Fennevesi and Gilbo arrive on a cold Monday morning to open in Dubuque. And they get in there, and sure enough, they look up, and the owl is sitting in the gallery. The manager's even got him looking at the rehearsal, you see, in the morning. And the stage manager greets them. And the stage manager is exactly like Ferry the Frog said, a big, handsome Claude Duval kind of a guy with an open shirt and so and so. And he immediately makes a big fuss over Mrs. Fennevesi, who is not in the act at all. gives her the number one dressing, and when they go up with the geese upstairs. Now they rehearse, and they're on second, which is again another problem to them. And finally, the show goes on, and the stage manager says, Mrs. Fenevis, you get right in here, and he's got her in the wings. I know you want to watch your husband. And he stands there with her, and they go out and do the opening parody on Some Bonnet Sue, whatever the hell it was, or so-and-so. And the Dutch comedian looks around, and the stage manager's got his arm just, you know, like this around Mrs. Fenevis, his wife. They go on with the next gag. The straight man sings the ballad. And while the ballad is going on, the stage manager is now caressing her breast. And the Dutch comedian takes this. Now he's got to do the parody right after that. He goes on, does the parody. As they turn around, the stage manager is leading Mrs. Fenevis behind the switchboard. And just as he gets into the important gag of the act, where were you that night where you were supposed to be at the party? He turns around, and the stage manager is putting his lava in Mrs. Fenevis. He sees it. He can't talk. The straight man, where were you that night at the party? And the Dutch man says, Jesus Christ, look what that guy is doing to my wife. The straight man says, fuck him. Watch the owl. Bring now to the microphone the luckiest straight man that ever lived in God's world. He did a vaudeville act first. He was Bernard of Bernard and Gary, Williams of Brown and the Williams Brothers, Mac of Mac Albright and Mac. And while working in the Nagasaki Japanese troupe, he was known as Abe Stern. I present to you Mr. George Burns.
And it's true, too. Thank you, Georgie, and Harry Joe Brown. I really should be in bed. I just got through doing our television show, and we filmed this in one day. And I'm so tired and exhausted, I probably won't remember one of the lines I was going to ad-lib tonight. But when they told me that I'd have to speak tonight, even though it's shooting day, I couldn't turn it down because Harry and I have been friends all our lives. Sort of been brought up together. We've had good times together and we've had bad times together. In fact, we both got a touch of Cupid's eczema from the same girl together. That was some girl, Trixie Hicks. Harry opened the show that night, and I was on number two. And I worked in full stage. Came at a very bad time. Made me lose a Charleston contest. 4 days later, I limped into Dr. Mylickson's office. And I saw Harry there. I says, Harry, what are you doing here? He says, I got a bad throat. Doctor says, take down your pants. I'd like to look at This was some office. Went there for about 4 months. I got so I knew every actor by his ass. But I gotta tell you a little story about Harry Joe. Harry and I were living at the Coolidge Hotel. He was going around with a girl then called Gladys Trueblood. She lived on the third floor and Harry lived on the ninth. Sometimes he'd go downstairs to see her, and then he'd come up. Sometimes she'd come up to see him and go down. Sometimes she'd come up and he'd go down. Sometimes they both went down. Once while he was down there, he ran into Lou Holtz. Must have been on a Friday night because Harry told me he wore his hat. This affair didn't last too long. Gladys Trueblood went back to Oklahoma City and Harry went back to have his throat treated. Then Harry left for the coast and got mixed up with Charles Rogers. And they went into the picture business. And Charlie was telling me how Harry got his first money. It seemed that Harry invented a machine that they used up in Alaska during the Yukon. And this machine made a fortune for him. The miners up there would want a woman, and they couldn't get any, so they'd finish up with some Eskimo woman. And they'd take this Eskimo upstairs, and then they'd come downstairs and put a half a dollar in Harry's machine, and in it would defrost their balls. I told Charlie, I says, that's not true, that's a lie. And he took off his pants and showed me a scar where he got one of his balls caught in the machine. Anyway, Harry, I'm very happy to be here tonight to say all these nice things about you.
In my new book, This Way, Miss, I lament upon the fact that the TV and the radio have done so little to bring forth any real great talents. In a forthcoming one, I've already made a series of notes in regard to a fine and handsome product of this newest, shall I say, of the arts. May God forgive me for lying. Mr. Art Linkletter.
Thank you, Harry Joe. And I really appreciate those compliments, George. I value them only slightly less than the franchise that you've granted me to have the sale of your book at the CBS lobby every day. We're doing a grand business with This Way, Miss. After my show each day, we do this for a small fee. I knew that sooner or later there'd be a testimonial dinner for you, Harry Joe. I read in the paper last year at an age slightly over 60, you were remarrying, and a testimonial dinner was inevitable. However, frankly, I expected it not from the maskers, but from the optimists. I was therefore somewhat taken aback when a long and lengthy and very literate wire arrived from the Harlequin inviting me to be here. And I was very pleased to be invited, except for one small word, which I knew would be in the wire, and that is, it will be stag. Now, in spite of what Mr. Jessel has told you about my seeming complacence and calm and erudition in front of an audience, you don't realize what happens to a man of my background and character to be invited to speak at a stag dinner where I know I'm going to be preceded by George Burns and George Jessel. I come from a type of show business where clean living, good thinking, most of the audience is born in wedlock. And to get into the mood to come here to talk to you in the vein, which I know you enjoy, requires at least 3 or 4 days of Jekyll and Hyde type preparation. Starting last Sunday with a complete rereading of George Jessel's book. Then on Monday, down at CBS Television City, going into the men's room and writing dirty words on the wall. On Tuesday, I knew I was getting into the mood when my children came down to breakfast, and I called them all little sons of bitches and said... This morning, when purely ad lib, I phoned my mother-in-law in San Diego and told her to go fuck herself. When this happened, I knew I was ready for tonight. I was ready, that is, insofar as the mood is concerned. However, I find myself severely handicapped in that I cannot get up here, as so many of the other members of the dais here, and reflect and recollect on the years past. And as Mr. Jessel so beautifully puts it in his book, any actor who hears anything mentioned longer than 20 years ago starts crying or laughing, no matter what it is. I am handicapped by the fact that 30 years ago, George Jessel was saying, "This way, miss," to some young girl in Central Park who had caught her high heels in the top of a Surrey. I was reading the Bobbsey Twins. 25 years ago, when Harry Joe was at Paramount producing some of his first larger pictures, and people like George Burns and Jack Benny and others were playing benefits at Polly Adler's in New York. I was discovering the first charms of puberty and mastering the technique of changing hands. So you see, I was at it. A few years later, Harry Joe was discovering Errol Flynn. Well, actually didn't discover him. It was a lucky break. They happened to be at the same motel together. I, at that time, was a disc jockey 20 years ago. KGB in San Diego, and I was learning the neat trick as a midnight disc jockey of committing adultery during the 3-minute period of Dardanella. Thing to do. So as I say, all these years have slipped by without my participating and also having come from this alien field. And all this time, Harry Joe was coming up and doing these wonderful, wonderful things. And I understand he now has a tremendous thing coming up next year, a benefit for King Farouk. They're going to build a big college there called Farouk U. And, as you can see, I'm just killing time because Harry, Joe, and I, while good friends, we have so little in common except for the one thing that for 40-some-odd years, Harry Joe was a bachelor. Was a bachelor. And while I have been married, I always feel a certain sympathetic aim with most bachelors in a quiet way. And Harry Joe, in my research, I discovered that while everything good has been said about him, there are a number of women around town who have even more interesting things to say than good. And the time is short, and I won't tell you those tonight, but you can pick them up in a 5-piece article which is coming out under my pen name, Sheehan, in Confidential, starting next month. Harry, they'll prove once again that you're among the best. Thank you.
In presenting your next speaker this evening, it is most easy to hurl superlatives in his direction. I know of nothing else to say to you than I know of no man who holds high place in the hearts and the affections of the people of America and those of the amusement world as does Jack Benny.
Thank you. I got brown all over waiting to go on. You know, when you have to follow fellas like Jessel and George Burns and Linkletter, you get that completely sunk feeling as though you left your script in Milton Berle's dressing room. I don't know, I'm always asked to speak late at these stag dinners. I guess the only word left for me tonight is fornicate. You know, I tried that once when I had to speak very late at a Friar's stag dinner. And I used the word fornicate. There was nothing else left. I used it in a joke. And unfortunately, nobody at the Friar's understood what it meant. Except Ronald Reagan. Then I found out that when I used the word, it wasn't that they didn't understand it, they didn't hear it, because after all the dirty stuff, by the time I got on, all the friars were playing with themselves. Next banquet, they had shorter tablecloths. But I, incidentally, I went to a party also given for Noel Coward Sunday by Frank Sinis, and at those parties, everybody tries to act so British, you know. And there was one dame there riding a Kotex side saddle. Few notes myself, because like Jessel, I also have to speak very, very often. I speak, I would say, almost as often as Jessel, not quite as much, but I've never spoken at a circumcision, of course. I just cried at mine. But when I was asked to speak here tonight, I was very, very hesitant, gentlemen, about coming, because although I like Harry Joe Brown very, very well, very much, I should say, I've known him for years, I didn't feel that he was a character who is conducive to stag material, you know? I mean, he isn't the kind of a shitheel that you can fun of, like, say, I don't think he's a shitheel comparable to some of the others here. We have here tonight, is it? Harry Joe Brown is, as I say, he's a kind of a fella that you don't associate with stag dinners. I don't know, he's worked for Columbia for years. Harry Cohn likes him. He's never been to a party dressed as a hamburger. So I didn't want to come for that reason, and I thought, well, I should come. And whether I'm late, I'll get here in time to speak, and I felt that knowing Harry so well, and he's done so much for others, that I should be here. And another reason I wanted to come is because I used to speak here quite often at the Maskers. And lately, I've been doing so much more for the Friars, and because now I am the abbot of the Friars, which is a very, very important executive position there. I would say that the abbot of the Friars is equivalent to a diaphragm for Christine Jorgensen.